This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
As I say, I can hold my head up and say, okay, what's not the departure I wanted? I wanted a few more months, perhaps to be campaigning on the things I want to campaign about as an MP. But as a political career, it was a lovely conclusion.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, and I'm your host, Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. This week we have a special programme devoted to one man, former Conservative MP for Thanet South, Craig McKinley, whose incredible journey in the past year brought him from death's door to knocking on the door of the House of Lords. For 9 years, Craig McKinley served as the Conservative MP for Thanet South, but last September his life changed forever when he contracted sepsis and lost his arms and legs. His illness and recovery has been played out very much in public and earned him a standing ovation from colleagues of all parties in the House of Commons. Now elevated to the House of Lords, Lord Craig McKinley joins me now. Hello, Craig.
Hello, good to be with you, yes.
Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, actually. Yes, obviously a year that I'd rather forget, but I suppose another chapter of life that you have to turn the page and get on with it and make the best of it, and I'm trying to do just that.
You hail from Kent originally. Can you just sort of outline your connection to the county?
Yeah, indeed. I was born in the Midway Towns in Chatham in All Saints Hospital. If you speak to anybody of a certain age anywhere around the Midway Towns, they'll say I was born there as well. Now long gone, a housing estate. But yes, I was born and raised in and around the Medway Towns, as were my parents. They came from the Medway Towns as well. So yeah, a few generations here. It was lovely. It was a great privilege to be able to serve as a Kent MP. Quite commonplace is that you don't get the opportunity of serving anywhere near where you were born, but it's lovely if you can. And serving in East Kent was a place I knew very, very well. A very big sailor. I've been sailing for many years around the Kent coast and, well, internationally. I did 35,000 miles in my old boat and knew the waters well, knew Ramsgate extremely well. It was always a place I went to regularly. So it was a great privilege to be able to serve it as the MP for those years. But yes, very much Kent in my veins and a few generations of.
Take us back a little bit, just rewind a little bit, back to the beginning of your illness. You know, when did you first start feeling unwell or that something wasn't quite right?
Well, it was the 27th of September last year. The Parliament was on recess, but I had been in my office for the day. And I was feeling just a little bit under the weather, no more than feeling, oh, well, I've got a bit of a late summer cold or whatever it might be coming on. So I didn't think much of it. And we were due to be going on holiday the next day on a very early morning flight. So I thought, I'll take myself off to bed a bit earlier than I might normally have done. I went to sleep quite happily. But then during the night, I was up a few times being sick, strangely sick. And then by the sort of early morning, my wife saying, you're just really not right here. Your arms are cold. I can't feel a pulse because we now know what's happening. You're having a loss of circulation. But she said, you're very pale. She's a pharmacist. So she did some of the basic things you'd expect somebody who has got some medical training to do. We even got out the COVID test that's at the back of the drawer. I think we all got one or two left from those days and tried that just in case it was COVID. That was negative. My temperature was okay and my blood pressure was okay, and they're usually signs of things going wrong. So all of that wasn't too bad, but I was feeling pretty lousy by then. So my wife called 999 and they came along, a couple of paramedics, and they again did their basic tests, and they were sort of unconvinced that I was ill enough to go to hospital, really. But after some persuasion from my wife, and also by then my brother-in-law had come, who was a GP, they did take me to hospital, and within about half an hour of being there, I had what's called a full septic shock. Went a very, very strange colour of blue. I mean, a very strange blue. And that was the start of what is the worst effects of sepsis. And you're in serious trouble. And from there on, I was put into an induced coma. So I don't really know much else for the next 16 days, frankly. But yeah, my body was going through the hell of sepsis, and they were fighting to keep me alive. And my wife was being told on that day, so we're talking 24 hours after feeling, you know, a little bit peaky, she was being told he probably hasn't got much chance of survival. We put it at about 5%. He's one of those people that we don't often see and hear that ill. So prepare for the worst. But we did pull through, got better and better as I suppose the full cocktail of antibiotics that they start pumping into you and whatever other magic they do. And yeah, I pulled through, was then moved up to St. Thomas's Hospital, which is obviously one of the best hospitals in the world, with, you know, fully fledged everything, teaching hospital and great experience and all of that on hand. And from there on, you know, well, I suppose I got better, but my arms and legs by then were turning black as the circulation had completely stopped. And you end up with a sort of necrosis, and they look like, well, I always liken them to sort of Pharaoh's arms, because they were completely dry and desiccated and actually covered in like an odd plastic. It was a weird material. It's just a little
bit like... What was that like to see your own body looking like that?
Well, it was dreadful. I'm dreadful. I suppose I was under the influence of various pain-relieving drugs and morphine and all the rest of it. So I realised, I mean, I was quite stoic about it looking back. I wasn't unbelievably shocked. I was sort of accepting that these arms and legs, they're finished. My wife was very hopeful. Oh, you know, they'll be okay, they'll be okay. I suppose that's what visitors always do. But I could see that these things were beyond help, really, especially as they were so desiccated and clawed. The hands were clawed and drying and just... honestly, a bit like something you see at the British Museum when you look at a mummy, frankly. I knew they were finished. And, yes, there I lay in hospital on the advice of my surgeon. His method of dealing with these things is to see how much can be saved, because that's really important, to try and keep as much length as you possibly can. Because if you can save joints, like elbows and knees, the outcome is always going to be that much better. It proved to be very good advice, because the arms and legs settled down over the next sort of 5 or 6 weeks, and it became clear what could be saved and what couldn't. And my amputations happened on the 1st of December, and yeah, managed to save below the elbows and below the knees. So, you know, a much better outcome than the alternative. And obviously all of that is a much better outcome than the alternative that they thought it was going to be, and that was death.
Yeah. Can you tell us about the story of when the Speaker of the House came to visit you?
Yeah, it was a lovely story. I mean, I must admit, I sort of embellished it a little bit for the Commons, but I had told the Speaker it before. He came in his full, you know, Speaker sort of outfit, you know, the morning suit, as it were, effectively. Like you might see people going to a wedding, that type of outfit, but also funeral directors are often in that type of outfit. So I raised the joke in Parliament that when the Speaker came, it did cause a bit of a stir, because, I mean, I sort of made this bit up a little bit because it was quite fun. I said they're all very, very concerned and sort of nudging each other and saying, that guy must be dreadfully unwell because you've already got the funeral directors in. And it did raise a little bit of a titter around the house, and it was quite fun. But I suppose that reflects my happy-go nature, my go-lucky nature and spirit that I have. And I think that has probably kept me going through some pretty dark times.
And Rishi Sunak also visited you, didn't he?
He did, yeah, multiple times. And it was very good of him, because a prime minister is a very, very busy person. They've got international obligations, obviously a lot of domestic obligations, obligations to ministers, cabinet, the House of Commons. So for him to have made time to come and see me was rather nice. And I probably had the benefit of having a longer period of having, you know, just a general person-to-person discussion about all sorts of just normal life and family matters and all the rest of it with the PM that I probably wouldn't have had the opportunity to do had I been fit and well and a backbencher in the House of Commons. So we had some good moments. I told him what I thought of some of his potential legislation around the corner, not always positive, but we had a good laugh and a good chat, actually. And so that was before I'd had my limbs off, and he came to see me after that as well. And I had visitors on a daily basis. I had lots of MPs at St. Thomas's, just over the bridge from Westminster. It was very easy. It's, you know, a mere 5 minutes walk over the bridge. So it was very regular, daily basis. I had a number of MPs in, a lot of Kent MPs, as you'd expect, close friends. But some of the groups that I'd moved in during my parliamentary times, the ERG group, the European Research Group for Brexiteers, of which I'm one. We held one of the weekly meetings in my hospital room. All of the names you'd recognise came to see me, and including Liz Truss and Boris Johnson.
Oh, he really? Supports him? Did he? Okay.
He came as well. And, oh, it was amazing. You could see that Boris effect. I mean, he'd been long gone as a PM, but the nurses were, well, you could see their eyes wide open. Wow, it's Boris. I can't believe it. So that Boris effect was still alive and well, and he was great fun.
Yeah. So you had three prime ministers, essentially.
I did. The only one, the only two across my period who didn't come were Theresa May and David Cameron. But I suppose I was sort of part of Theresa May's downfall, so I wasn't expecting her to come.
Well, that's fair enough. You know where artificial arms and legs, first bionic lord, perhaps. Yep. How have you found
that? Just to get that in context, I'm waiting my letters patent to be signed by His Gracious Majesty the King, which should happen any day, and then I will officially be lord.
Okay.
So it's on the way, I hope. Yes.
Yes. What's the swearing-in procedure?
I've only ever seen friends go through, and I've been outside the chamber in the sort of the Lord's lobby, a bit like on the other end in the Commons lobby. But apparently there is a bit of a ceremony. I went up to London last week to see, of all things, the Garter Principal King of Arms.
Mm-hmm.
Who occupies the College of Arms, a very ancient building in the City of London, just off. It's actually very, very close to St Paul's. It's within sight of St Paul's.
Mm-hmm.
And he agrees your title and offers you the opportunity to have a coat of arms done and all of this type of thing. But he is involved in some of the ritual. There's quite a ritual, and you've got a sort of recitation of the letters patent signed by the king and all of that. So it's it does hark back to days of old, and it's that type of parliamentary tradition that I very much like and respect and hopefully will enjoy. You have the opportunity to take friends and family to be in the gallery to watch it happening. You borrow the... Yeah, I suppose you can buy them if you so wish, but you've got the Red Rove and Ermine, but I think there's sufficient there for you to borrow for the day.
Mm.
And you do the ceremony. They only do two a day, twice a week. So given there are a few that have been made up at the Dissolution Honours List and the new Prime Minister has appointed some ministers via the Lords, I'm a bit of the back of the queue, so it'll probably be early October, I think.
The question I was about to ask you, actually, was, you know, where these artificial arms and legs? I mean, how did you find that transition?
It's certainly not easy, I can tell you. I mean, I'm on sort of Mark II legs at the moment. They sort of start you through various ones. First ones are very, very bulky, and they don't have an ankle that moves, which makes going up and down stairs and up and down slopes very, very tricky. But as you go through the journey, you get better and better ones. I'm now on ones that have got an ankle that moves a bit. It's sort of a hydraulic ankle. And yeah, the walking isn't too bad. It's not comfortable, but I regularly do over 6,000 steps a day,
mm-hmm.
which even for someone able-bodied is probably up there with what most people do on a daily basis. So the legs aren't really an issue. And you see people with artificial legs and you wouldn't even know that they've got them. I must say, if I have long trousers on rather than shorts, I mean, shorts are far more comfortable, obviously, in this weather. You wouldn't particularly know that I've got artificial legs. My gait is pretty good. You might think I've got a sort of stone in my shoe. That's about all, really. But the arms and hands are very different. I mean, they're good as far as they go. And you can pick things up. Pick glasses up. You can do a few things, but they're not as good as the real thing, as it were. Not as good as your original hands and arms and fingers. Nowhere like. But they're better than what the NHS are currently giving me, which is frankly a bit of a sort of rubber hook, which I'm not entirely sure what you're meant to do with two of those, and hence that's going to be part of my campaign. It's rather silly that the NHS will give you the multi-articulating sort of clever bionic arms in time, but you might wait 3 years for them, and you think, well, why make people wait for 3 years for something you will provide anyway, when they can get on with a bit more of a normal life, and not an issue for me, mental health issues, I'm always cheerful, but for some, 3 years with two rubber hooks, I don't think is going to take you to a very good place, because you can do very little for yourself with those. Mm. So it's not just getting people back feeling better, looking normal or as normal as you can, but it's perhaps getting them back to work and doing something productive. And that I think is important. I would have thought that is part of what the NHS is trying to achieve and is there for.
Are you going to use your your new position as a lawyer to push for that? And what effectively?
Yeah, very much. So,
what effectively can you do?
Well, it's like many things. What can MPs, backbench MPs, do? Well, not a lot. What can Lords do? Well, not a lot. But they do have a voice, and you know, you've got Hansard, and the media does follow what's happening in the House, and you get the opportunity to go on programmes like yours and others, where there's an interest in a story like mine, because it is somewhat unusual. I suppose it's made that much more unusual that I'm going to become a peer of the realm. So yes, it's an opportunity to have a voice. And obviously the new health secretary, I've got his phone number. I'll no doubt be sitting down with him and, you know, explaining to him the experience that I've had, and with a hope that he'll say, yeah, that's really not quite right. Let's see if we can do something better. So if what I've gone through can actually make people coming down the track who are yet to be afflicted with sepsis and yet to have what I've had, and there's not many a year, there's only about half a dozen, because most people tend to die, or they certainly did years ago, but with medical advances, you've got a better chance of survival. If I can get one of those people in the future getting better prosthetics earlier, then I'll see that as a job well done. There's also a job of work to do in recognising sepsis. Sepsis is one of the biggest killers in the UK. I mean, granted, some of them are like the sort of thing that you die of when you're end of life. You know, if it wasn't sepsis that killed you, it'd probably be, you know, chest infection or something. You know, many of those are what you might call end of life infections that you could probably do little about. But there will be many, many thousands of younger people who will die of sepsis every year. I mean, in my case, I don't think much could be done because it came on so unbelievably quickly. But the usual route is that you get a few days grace where you're feeling increasingly unwell. If we can, during that period, have family, friends go, do you know what, I'm more aware of sepsis and I'm concerned that is what you might have, you might be able to get to people earlier, get them into the health system that does know what to do with sepsis.
A bit like meningitis, where, you know, the awareness of meningitis, especially in children, is so much greater than it was.
Absolutely. And also, if you think of the stroke campaign, the FAST campaign, I mean, that's now entrenched within us. So I think perhaps if I can be part of making people think more about sepsis and saving a few people from getting to the stage that I'm in, or even worse, towards death, then that will again be a job well done. You know, perhaps there are other things going on here. I mean, my mother passed away with an autoimmune disease. It was rheumatoid arthritis. Shouldn't really kill you, but in some people, if it's very serious, it does. Does that mean that I had an autoimmune deficiency within my genetics? Is there a genetic test, of which we hear of so many more now for all different types of ailments and illnesses, that perhaps would have recognised, you are likely to be more susceptible to an autoimmune disease like sepsis, because that's what it is. It's your body going completely berserk at the response to an infection. So perhaps you would be able to have a more of a risk list of people. And then further than that, you think what we managed to achieve with COVID, with rapid testing, and we had test kits at home, and what we have with glucose tests for those who are diabetic, in a very easy prick finger tests, is there perhaps some type of easy test that we could have that would be recognising markers of likely sepsis? And I know lactate levels are one of the measures, and I had that test, and that was what confirmed it at Medway Hospital. You know, are there these sort of easier tests that people would be able to go, right, let's do a finger prick test. You're on the pathway here to sepsis. So, yeah, perhaps what I've gone through will be a force for good amongst the health service and across the country to actually save a few lives in the future. And that will make my life very well worth living.
Just for the benefit of listeners who perhaps don't know what sepsis is, what exactly is it? What happens to you?
Well, sepsis is not a disease in itself. Sepsis is the response that your body does, your own internal immune system, going haywire at an infection. I mean, they put mine down as the best estimate they could have was pneumonia.
Yeah.
The trouble is pneumonia, we all carry pneumonia. I think if you did a swab up your nose today, there would be evidence of pneumonia. Whether it actually then advances to something and, you know, infects your lungs and all the rest of it is another matter. But they put mine down to pneumonia, you know, a run-of-the-mill type of infection that we all carry, and it had an effect on my immune system to go berserk. Meningitis, we mentioned earlier, is often one as well, and often in children, the disease that has then moved on to sepsis is often meningitis. But there was a guy in hospital, same ward, his sepsis had been started from an insect bite.
Oh, really?
So it can be from a variety of things. Mm. I mean, I've heard over the years, you know, people have had, you know, a prick on the finger from a rose bush in the garden that was led to sepsis and death. So it can be anything. It can be a wide variety of things. It is your own immune system going haywire that then causes the clots and then causes blockages in your fingers and your arms and your legs, or causes your organs to stop working and you die. I mean, my organs did start to fail. I had kidney failure for a few days. The liver wasn't too good, but it all recovered. But yes, it's purely autoimmune response. So there's something going on within your genetics of your immune system, I would think, that perhaps could be recognised.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Back to politics. You went back to the Commons, made that famous speech, which got a very warm and heartfelt round of applause. And then literally, I think, I can't remember, hours later, Rishi Sunak called an election. Did you feel a little bit robbed and not being able to spend a bit more time in the Commons?
It was a shame because I'd seen that when I was lucky to go back and talk, because I could have easily gone, you know what, my leg hurts a bit today, I'll leave it a couple of weeks. It was really quite lucky that I decided to choose that day. But yes, I thought it was going to be my first day back of a, you know, going back a bit more regularly as the weeks went on. Then we'd have the, you know, the summer recess, then we'd have another few weeks back, and then we'd have the conference recess, and then I suppose we'd have gone into a general election. That was what everybody was thinking was going to be the agenda for the months ahead. But no, having given my speech within hours, election was called, much to everybody's sort of shock, really.
Why do you think he called it early?
I wish I knew the answer to that, because nobody else knows the answer to it either. I really, really don't know. It's a mystery, frankly. I would have thought some of the feeling better or feeling good measures would have come back a bit over the next few months, particularly even the Bank of England, an institution I don't actually hold much respect for. Even they would have had to put interest rates down at some time across the summer and early autumn period. And perhaps we'd have started feeling better about the state of the economy. And you know, a lot of the measures in the economy are in pretty good shape. Inflation is down to 2% and our growth rates are better than anywhere else in the G7. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, far, far from it. And that would have, I think, felt a bit better after the summer and into the autumn. And in my view, that would have been a better time to hold the election. But, you know, it's a gift of the Prime Minister, and that's what he decided to do. I mean, now we look back at, was that a good decision? Well, patently not, when we're only left with 121 Conservative MPs. But now everybody was a bit mystified by that. But just going back to my speech, there is that old saying that all political careers end in failure. I can hold my head up and say my last day in Parliament was probably my finest hour.
Give us your
Others across the chamber, you know, some long in the tooth, as I spoke to Bill Cash, very, very good friend, been in the House for 40-odd years. Sir Roger Gale, my old parliamentary neighbour, he'd been in the House for 43 years. And some of the long in the tooth journalists who've been there for 30 years, they said it was probably the most emotional day and hairs on the back of your neck type feeling of electricity in the House that they'd ever seen. And we do go hammer and tong against each other across the chamber, and that isn't always the most edifying experience. I think behaviour in the Lords is a little more refined, but you know, we have confrontational politics. But on that day, to have the entirety of the House on their feet, you know, clapping, crying. Actually, I had many friends in tears, and I had emails from some Labour colleagues who said, I was in tears watching you do that. And you know, it was good fun, and some of the jokes I was telling, it was a day they won't forget. So, as I say, I can hold my head up and say, okay, what's not the departure I wanted? I wanted a few more months, perhaps to be campaigning on the things I want to campaign about as an MP. But as a political career, it was a lovely conclusion.
Yeah, I suppose it wasn't bad timing, really, when you think about it.
No, it wasn't. I mean, me as a bit of a, you know, someone who quite likes being in the media, I suppose if the election hadn't been called, I'd have perhaps made a bit more media that evening. Yeah. But that's just me being rather selfish.
Yeah. Listen, let's talk about the result. You know, the Conservatives, I mean, the polls were saying it for you know, a long time. And you and I had a conversation just before you became ill, We talked sort of, you know, in a fairly honest way about what we thought was going to happen in Kent. And you thought, well, no, the polls will tighten, things will be okay, and maybe it won't be anywhere near as bad as the polls suggested. Clearly, that didn't happen. But, you know, Keir Starmer has managed to get himself a landslide on 34% of the vote. But the fact is, that's the way the system works.
It is.
But why did the Conservatives lose so heavily?
Well, there's a few things around that. I mean, number one, the Labour win, I'm not taking it away from them. It's the first past the post system, and there's 650 little battles going on across the UK. That's how our system works. And if you get enough soldiers across the line, in enough of those, you will form the government. But there was one result that I looked at in Kent, and that was Sitting Bull and Sheppey.
Yeah.
That was one with 29% of the vote, which is really a very bizarre result. That very rarely happens. And
but it's the bellwether, though, isn't it? Dartford's a bellwether, sorry.
But it is. But to win a parliamentary seat with 29% of the vote is somewhat unusual. But yeah, that's the system. But we did have the effect of reform came in at a later stage, which I hadn't foreseen when we spoke probably last year. Reform got every right to stand. Of course they have. But that was a fault of ours that we allowed that vacuum to be created that Reform felt that they could fill and advertise to the public. I mean, I'm making the assumption that most Reform votes would normally have gone to the Conservatives. I think that is a fair assumption. It won't be entirely true, but there'll be a few Labour voters who have voted Reform, of course, and some people who just would stay at home and say none of the above have gone out to vote Reform because they like what they had to say. But we lost a lot of votes to Reform. If you look at the votes that we went down to, I think we went down from, well, we halved our vote. I think we had 13 million under Boris Johnson, big win in 2019, and we went down to 6.5 million. And the Reform vote was 4 million. The Dem vote went up a fair bit, which lost us some of that, what you call your sort of Surrey type Conservative seats. The blue wall became yellow wall. So there were some odd things going on which I couldn't have foreseen in last year. But also, I would have foreseen that you'd go to an election when things are better under those measures that I described, like interest rates starting to come down, like a little bit of feeling a little better about things coming back into the fray. I would never have thought you'd go to the polls when the polls are so bad. Obviously, you have to go to the polls at the 5-year end of term statutory requirement time. But when you still have a little bit of discretion left in the tank, I wouldn't have thought you'd have done it then. I mean, I said to colleagues, if you're a condemned man, you're not going to pull the rope early. Okay, we might have been condemned in November, but I don't think the result would have been quite so bad. And also, on the Reform side of things, Nigel Farage, who I was the last one to beat in South Thanet in 2015, he'd have probably been around, dabbling around with Donald Trump by then. So he may not have had such an interest in standing. So, lots of things were not clever decisions, not well thought through. And, there were a few bits went wrong during the election, like they always do. I mean, Labour said nothing about anything very much. Top marks to them. It's often a way you do get over the line. We saw a bit of about what they're thinking about with them.
That's a great skill, isn't it, to manage to get through an election campaign without actually committing to anything?
It is. Really. Well, I mean, I think we saw some of the reality with Rachel Reeves yesterday. There is an awful lot they will be landing upon us that they didn't tell us about during the election. I call that not good politics. It's not how I behave. I'd rather tell people exactly what I stand for, and that you can win or fall on what you do stand for, not keep things hidden. And if you want to discuss any of that, the thought of taking £200 winter fuel allowance from a lot of very poor pensioners, I cannot frankly believe. When you then give an inflation busting rise to a lot of the public sector, I just find that a little peculiar. I'm just very a mixed thing to do, frankly. But anyway, that's for them to decide.
Yeah.
But during the election period, we had a few things go wrong. I'm not going to brush them under the carpet. The betting scandal, it's not great news. And it upset a few people on the doorstep. I know colleagues were saying it did come up. And when you look at some of the seats that we lost, I think there was Paul, Sir Robert Sims, lovely man, known him for years. He lost by 18 votes. And Stephen Metcalfe in one of the South End seats, got a long-term MP. He lost by 86 to, fun enough, to Reform. And when you have those tight ones across a number of seats, you only need some little ripple to have gone wrong. And you realise that perhaps that little betting scandal probably took Sir Robert Sims out. It was enough to put 18 people off
that would
have got him over the line. So, you know, little things like that that always happen during generals.
But in it, rarely but in the broader sense, you know, those are the specific things. You know, we didn't see the reform coming in the betting scandal. There's little things in the actual sort of, which actually happened in the campaign. But over the 5 years, you go from having a landslide victory of 80 seats to losing and getting, you know, walloped down to 120-something. You know, something has gone seriously badly wrong during that parliament for people to lose their their trust in you so completely.
I'll tell you exactly what's happening here. The old days where people always voted Labour or always voted Conservative, I mean, I've knocked on doors over the years in various seats and people say, no, I vote Labour, my parents have voted Labour, I've always voted Labour, or even, you know, the other side, oh yeah, we're Conservative, my parents have been Conservative. Those sort of days have gone. And I'll tell you why they've gone. They've actually gone a bit because of, I think, the UKIP Brexit Party effect over the years. I mean, as you know, I was one of the founders of UKIP. Mm. It actually, particularly the Brexit Party, I'd say, at those European elections when it did very well, and UKIP before it did very well in European elections, it made people in various seats actually change from what they'd always done for a generation. They went to a halfway house or a different place that they'd never been before. They had been shaken out of their normal voting intention. And that assisted us in 2019 when we got our semi-landslide, 80 majority, you know, lovely majority to have, because a lot of those seats, particularly the Red Wall seats, they'd already moved in European elections, you know, albeit low turnout elections. So they were happy to move again and they moved to us. But what this does mean is that the electorate is far more movable and fickle than it ever used to be. So there's a message there, obviously, for us, how you can go from an 80 majority to a stomping loss in one mere parliament. You would think an 80 majority in old money would take you through at least two before you've lost it. But there's a message there for Labour that, yes, they've won handsomely under first past the post in a very, very, quite a thin majorities in lots of seats, and, you know, a few hundred or thousands of votes would have changed the result. That can swap very, very, very quickly. So you've got to be, you know, honeymoon on honeymoon to save that. And that's not going to last throughout these 5 years. I thought a number of pensioners who are going to be deprived of their £200 are saying, oh dear, what did I do that for? Mm-hmm. Is this what these people are all about? And you wait till that budget comes along and perhaps has measures against pensions, measures against capital gains tax, perhaps measures against inheritance tax, which will be very, very clobbering of people in the southeast. And I think people will say, actually, I thought this Labour Party was different, but it's looking much the same as the Labour Party I booted out in 2010. So this could all change very quickly. We went through a lot of prime ministers. Of course we did. We all know the story of that. But the one thing that wasn't mentioned during the election campaign enough, if it was mentioned at all, I mean, I tried to mention it, was, yes, we got one of the highest tax burdens that we've had for 70 years. I'm not proud of that as a Conservative. I'm a low-tax libertarian Conservative. Mm-hmm. But everybody seemed to overlook, we spent £500 billion supporting the economy through furlough, through help out to body or eat out to help out, and all those other schemes to keep the economy going, keep jobs going, keep businesses afloat during that COVID period. And we didn't really mention that. You can't possibly spend that much money in a very short period and expect there to be no outcome. And that outcome was higher taxes than most of us would have liked. You also had the external shock of Putin's illegal war in Ukraine, which caused energy prices to go up. No other reason. That was the reason energy prices went up. And that fed through into every single thing that we do, buy, eat, and everything else. And that's why we had high inflation and then high interest rates. So these were external factors, nothing to do with what the Conservative Party did. These were all externally derived. We just happened to be in the driving seat when these things hit. And you look across Europe just at the moment at the recent European parliamentary elections, most of the governments across Europe were more left of centre governments. They've all fallen to the right. Everybody has voted against whoever's been in the saddle while we've had a few years of great difficulties. We were in the saddle during the period of COVID. I mean, I could argue that I think we went too far with some of the measures. I argued against just about all of them. But we were in the saddle when we had that difficult period. We were in the saddle when we had to deal with inflation. So people naturally think, well, it must be the Conservatives at fault. Well, we weren't. If Labour had been in the saddle, you heard just as I did during that COVID period, they wanted earlier lockdowns, longer lockdowns, more expensive lockdowns. So we'd have been actually in a worse situation. And the externality of the price rise shock of gas and oil and everything else on the back of the Ukraine war would have been exactly the same under Labour. So, if Labour had been in government across these last 5 years, they would right now have been totally booted out because people would have thought it's their fault. We didn't get enough support. So I'm voting against them. So, at times there are historical factors that just work against you. And of course, we've got our own internal bits and pieces like changing prime ministers rather too readily, which doesn't look very stable either. So, a lot of things in play here. But the big thing is people don't stick with what they've always voted for.
Yeah, so there is that.
They move.
Yeah, there is that fluidity. Okay, well, just turning over to the leadership contest, where I think we've got six candidates. I mean, if you were still an MP, who would you be backing?
I will be backing, and I haven't decided yet. The last decade has been the battle for Brexit. That has pulled apart the country, has pulled apart political parties. The next decade will be the battle for energy security and cost. And I will be backing whatever candidate is willing to have a serious, sensible look at net zero and the pathway that we're currently on. I set up the Net Zero Scrutiny Group because I've got concerns about the cost of net zero. Is it affordable? Is it achievable? Is there a better way? And by the by, we're only actually responsible for 1% of global output of CO2, and all the while China, India and others are not doing too much about it. You have to wonder, why are we getting rid of all high energy businesses from the UK and charging consumers more? You have to worry or wonder, well, actually, why are we doing this in the first place when we're such a small output? Mm. But I will be supporting whichever candidate can give me an absolute assurance that this will make us look very different from the Labour Party. I was on various media over the weekend, and I forecast that energy will bring the Labour Party down over the next... Well, it will be the one issue that will bring them down. It won't be this year, it won't be next year, it might not even be at year four or five, but it will be the issue that will bring them down, because consumers, when they're faced with unbelievably expensive energy, are being asked to completely change the way we live, will be saying, well, I don't think I'm going to continue voting for that. So if we end up with a Conservative leader that is just exactly on the same pathway on this net zero 2050 and all that goes with it, then I'm afraid I will not be supporting them. I will be actively against them. So that is where my bet will be lying. Mm. And if any of those potential candidates hear this podcast, if they want my vote, they know what to do.
Okay. The other thing I was going to ask you was, I mean, and this is not just to pick your favourite two, but who do you think will make the final two to go to the members?
Yeah, because this is always the oddity of the way we do things within Conservative selection. You have... Because on the one hand, you have to have, and we're not selecting a prime minister this time, of course. We're selecting a leader of the opposition that's in for a very, very tough job to try and pull the party around into a position where it might be able to win power into the future. So a very different position from selecting a PM, which we've done over the last few selection processes. You have the difficulty that members make a choice out of the last two, but it's MPs on a daily basis that have to work with whoever emerges from that system. Now, therein is a conflict. And me as a Democrat would say, well, the members are king because they pay the money, they run the associations, they're the councillors, they're the ones knocking on doors, they're the ones who come to the fundraising dinner, so they have to be part of the process. But realistically, it is the MPs who have to actually work with them. So therein is a difficulty, which is not easy to solve. So the MP's decision might always be different from what the member's decision might be. Now, the members will always, always, always go for the more right-of-centre candidate that is in front of them, because that is the nature of members of the Conservative Party. That is the nature of virtually every association. OK, there'll be some that might be a bit more centre, one nation type, but generally our membership, I think, is more reflective of the country and is more likely to be right-of-centre. But the MPs are often a little bit more centrist. Now, the opposition wouldn't say that many Conservative MPs are centrist, but I can assure you many of them are. So who will get through. You'll have so much game playing going on, and 121 people who are in that selection process, 121 MPs, means that lots of games can be played.
It's a very small pool, though, isn't it?
It is. That's what I mean. You can't play such a big game when you had 350 MPs, but that game playing can be much more effectively played with 121, where just a few changes here and there and lending votes and whatever shenanigans, which you can imagine goes on, could change an outcome. Who will be the last two? It'll definitely be, I would say, a right-winger will go through. It'll be a right-winger and a centrist, and then the right-winger will win when it goes to the public. Who those two are? Well, the right, you'd have to say at the moment, I suppose it's Kemi Badenoch and Priti Patel, and possibly Robert Jenrick, who's now sort of saying the right things, particularly on immigration. And the others are more centrist, I would say. And I've lost track of who the third one is. Yes, of course, Mel Stride. Yeah, I mean, a great man, known very, very well. He's actually a very good friend of mine. He's come and stayed with us socially. And you've got Tom Tugendhat, Kent MP. He is a centrist, One Nation type MP. That's absolutely fine. And then you've got the third one's James Cleverly, who was a Brexiteer, but has been part of numerous administrations, which from the outside looking in has not looked all that right of centre. So, yeah, it's going to be one from one camp and one from the other, I would say, and then the one of the right of centre. Who though likely to be? I'm not part of the 121 likely to be part of that very big shuffleboard of playing chess in September when MPs come back from the summer recess.
Okay, if you were to go down to Ladbrokes and put a punt on, who would you say the one for the right and one for the centre would be? What would your punt be?
Oh, I couldn't hazard a guess. This could go any which way. This would be a bet I would not make, because I only make a bet when I think I've got a bit of a sniff of what the reality outcome might be. Mm. And on this one, I'm sorry to say, I do not have the magic glasses on.
But you do think that it'll be one centre, one right winger, and the right winger will probably win because that's what the members like.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. What will you be known at in the Lords? Have you decided what your
I have, title? Yes. Yeah. When I went to see the Garter Principal King of Arms last week, which was a lovely name, what a lovely role to have. He is there to agree the title with you. I obviously went there with a number of thoughts. Because traditionally, because I was an MP for South Thanet constituency, now it's East Thanet, so there's been some changes. It is traditional, because the only reason I've become a peer is because I was an MP. So it is the done thing to do is to reflect part of your old constituency in your new title.
Mm-hmm.
So I've looked geographically at the place, and my old seat was in two halves, really. It was the more town part of a bit of Cliftonville. You had Ramsgate Broadstairs through Pegwell Bay, and then the southern bit was Sandwich and the villages going inland a little bit up to Wingham. Slap bang in the middle is a little place called Richborough, which I always remember seeing Richborough Power Station when I used to go sailing along the North Kent coast, because when you're off about Whitstable, you could actually see across the fairly flat land of the Isle of Thanet, and you could actually see Richborough Power Station right the way around Northumberland on the other side, and you could see it. Richborough is actually, nobody lives there very much, I think if anybody lives there at all. It has got a massive history. It was where it is said the Romans first landed, and there's a bit of a battle going on. Was it Richborough or was it Chichester? But, you know, I'll take Richborough any day. It's got the fort there, the Roman fort, which is well worth a visit. It was the site of quite a big port in its day. It was where nearly all the equipment that went out to the First World War went out through Richborough.
Oh, okay.
So a little known fact, not really used now, quite silted up. And I don't think a major ship has been in there for quite some time. And energy being a very important thing of what I think the next decade is going to be all about. It has all of those things, has either gone on there or will go on there. It had the old power station, coal-powered in its day, on back of Kent Coal. Then it burnt this very strange oil emulsion from the Orinoco Basin in South America. I mean, why on earth you want to burn that? Heaven only knows. And then it was knocked down. It is the site of the interconnector that comes through from Belgium. Broadly coal-powered energy coming through an interconnector to the UK. I'm sure there's much green about that, but that's deemed to be net zero and carbon-free, but such is the peculiarity of how we account for these things. There is a plan in there for a big battery farm, to store renewable energy. And it's where a lot of the energy comes in from the wind farms. So it has got quite a pivotal place, not only in history, not only what I'm really interested in, the story of energy and where it's going to end up. It is right in the slap bang in the middle of my old constituency. And because nobody lives there much, no one's upset that they haven't been included. And also, I think Lord McKinley of Richborough has got quite a nice little ring to it.
Yeah.
So that's where, but it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to do at all. It's really quite complex because a name could be your name for the rest of your days. So it's not to be done lightly.
Absolutely.
But yes, I'm very pleased that it's part of my old constituency features in it.
Craig McKinley, Lord Craig McKinley of Richborough, many thanks for your time today. And we wish you all the very best for the future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that's your lot. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics news from across the county. Until next time, all the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.